So, let's finish up the last lecture. The last lecture was broadly about taxation, but I think, as I said, the way to think about taxation is primarily about the process through which we collectively allocate part of our total social resources to solve common problems, collective problems, problems that can't be solved by individuals acting simply on their own, on the basis of their own interests. And that requires resources. That vision of the use of taxation then corresponds to this idea of an affirmative state, where the state is seen as something that really serves our collective purposes. It affirms. Affirmative is a term that I and Joel Rogers used to describe this way of thinking about the state. It's a state that has affirmative role, a positive role in the society, as opposed to the government being something out there that dominates us and is serving its own purposes. No, it's serving our purposes. That's the whole idea of a democratic society, is that we have a capacity to actually decide to solve collective problems and allocate the resources for it. So the connection between the discussion of taxation and this problem of the attack on the affirmative state is that if you really don't believe in an affirmative state, if you want a minimal state that just provides basic public security, public safety, it's essentially a state of law and criminal justice, but not a state that actively tries to solve problems and facilitate our lives. Well, one way to dismantle, to attack the affirmative state is to undermine its capacity for taxes. Grover Norquist, who is one of the great spokesmen for the attack on the affirmative state, basically admitted, he said straightforwardly, that the reason to attack taxes is to starve the beast. That was his expression. That's his self-characterization of what the whole point of having massive taxes are, tax cuts. It's not that massive tax cuts to benefit the rich will ultimately help everyone because it would lead to more investment. You know, that's another kind of justification. No, he said the reason to cut taxes is because it makes it impossible to run the government at this expansive public affirmative role. So that's the connection between the discussion of taxation and the attack on the affirmative state. Taxation is about how we get the resources for an affirmative state. The attack is on the opposition to such a state. And as I said fairly hurriedly towards the end of the lecture, there are three broad defenses of the affirmative state in terms of the values that we laid out at the beginning of the semester. The value of democracy requires a broad role for the state, because to really have a democratic society, you have to be able to engage and solve those problems that are part of our collective lives. And that's a big scope, not a narrow scope. So it's the state as a problem-solving institution under democratic control. That's part of the value of democracy. The values of efficiency, prosperity, and fairness require expansive public goods rather than a very narrow conception of what the state provides. And it requires economic regulation. A deregulated economy is not a more efficient economy. It's an economy in which the inefficiencies are imposed as costs on the public, a deregulated economy. And finally, the value of positive freedom actually requires, I think, a fairly strong form of state intervention. Positive freedom requires an expansive understanding of opportunities for people to live their lives the way they want. Not just their freedom from interference, that's negative freedom, but actually living in an environment that provides the necessary facilities to have an expansive set of opportunities. And again, particularly in a market economy, a state is required to do that. So that's the basic defenses of an affirmative state. That's why we need it. There are then these three primary attacks on the affirmative state, which I, again, hurriedly went through at the end of the last lecture. First, there's an attack on the legitimacy of taxation itself. Taxes, to say it in the extreme form, taxation is theft. Taxation is the government taking money away from the people who earned it who know better how to use their money than the government does. It treats the government as this alien entity that's appropriating your resources for its own purposes, not for your purposes as members of a community, but for its own purposes. That's an attack on the basic legitimacy of taxation, and essentially argues that taxes should be as low as possible, consistent with maintaining the institutions of law and order. So even libertarians who hate taxes acknowledge that we need taxes to provide for police departments and prisons and courts. If you're going to have private property, you're going to have disputes over private property, and you need to have some way of adjudicating it. And they agree that is a public responsibility. And you'll need taxation to support the military. You have to defend yourself from attack. But that's a pretty limited list. No money for health care, no money for public education, no money for redistribution for helping people who are disadvantaged or disabled or whatever. That's the minimalist state, and that attacks the legitimacy of taxation. The second attack is on the intentions of government. That particular attack has actually increased over time. It's most stark, I think, in the recent presidential elections, where the expression "drain the swamp," that expression is an indictment of the people in government as being out for their own interests and not the common good. Now, of course, there's a grain of truth in that. There's lots of corruption in our political system. There's lots of people, because of the influence of money, that do indeed gain special access to the centers of power and use it for their purposes. So that is absolutely right. But the general characterization that the problem in the United States is the antagonism between political elites on the one hand and the people, rather than between corporate elites. So if you're going to create a populist vision of us versus them, well, the us is us, ordinary folks. Who's the them? Who is the antinomy? Who is the opposition? Who is the corrupt, nefarious, self-seeking elite to oppose? That's the expression populism generally refers to a way of thinking about politics as polarized between the people and some antinomy, some other than the people. Call it the elite. Well, one target is it's the politicians in Washington. It's Washington versus the people. The other is that it's Wall Street versus the people. These are two iconic ways of talking about who the enemy is. Is it Wall Street, bankers, and more generally the wealthy 1%? That's the Occupy movement. We are the 99%. It's the 1% of the wealth holders. Or is it the top of the political system? Well, increasingly, I think, there is an attack on the very intentions and purposes of leadership in the political system. So that the Environmental Protection Agency is attacked because the scientists who study climate change are only interested in getting grants to further their careers. They don't care about the environment. This attack on the scientific elite, particularly government-funded science, is an attack that says all of these people are just interested in feathering their own nests. They have no commitments to the truth, the content of the science that they do. That's part of the justification for defunding in a very significant way the Environmental Protection Agency, and particularly the research aspects of the Environmental Protection Agency, including destroying data that has already been gathered around climate change. Okay, that's the attack on the intentions of government. Government is malevolent. And the third attack is on the competence of government. There may be lots of really well-meaning bureaucrats out there. They may have the well-being of the world in their hearts, but they just don't have the capacity to do anything about it. They fumble about, they create red tape, they create regulations in the hope of being able to reduce toxic waste, for example, or in the current Wisconsin controversies, they create regulations to reduce manure runoff from farms. But they're all thumbs and no fingers. It's incompetent. They over-regulate and create impediments to efficiency, to profit-seeking corporations who are only interested in helping develop and create jobs. So the typical way of framing this is that the incompetence of government hurts ordinary people by raising the cost of things and by destroying jobs. That's not the malevolence argument. It's an incompetence argument. Well, taken together, these are three pretty potent kinds of criticisms. And they do constitute a kind of package. Different elements get emphasized at different times. But this has been at the center of conservative politics around the issues of state and economy. Conservative politics for the last 40 or 50 years, last 40 years, let's say, since the late 1970s to the present. And it's been a remarkably successful attack. It has undermined the legitimacy of the government. It has reduced people's confidence that taxes are worth paying because they serve common purposes. This has led to transformations of the state, transformations of the affirmative state, transformations in ways that affects the lives of most people. First and most obviously, there's cutbacks of publicly funded programs. These are just examples. I mean, this isn't a comprehensive list, obviously. Less funding for higher education, and therefore higher tuition. So one way of thinking about tuition is it's a kind of tax that's imposed on people who want a university education. We don't charge tuition for high school or for elementary school. If you live in a city, your education K through 12 is paid for directly by taxes. So tax cuts around property taxes and around K through 12 education may lead to bigger class sizes, may lead to deterioration of the physical infrastructure of schools. It may lead to teachers having a higher turnover rate because they burn out more easily. But it doesn't lead to increased costs to the families of children going to the university, going to K through 12 education. Reduced funding to public higher education, on the other hand, displaces the cost of higher education from the public, that is, as part of our collective responsibility to provide for a highly educated population, to the individual who go to university. It's a way of treating universities as a form of consumption, an individual investment, rather than as you are now participating in a collective process of producing a highly educated labor force that makes for a better society. Now, of course, universities have both a public and a private dimension. There are aspects of it that do increase your earnings. Your potential for earnings are enhanced by virtue of going to university. But the relationship between the potential enhancement of your earnings and the increased costs of higher education are completely out of whack at this point. That is, the displacement of costs onto the shoulders of those getting higher education in the form of higher tuition has really reduced the value of higher education to people. Because it means you have to spend so much money getting a higher education degree, and you have to pay off those loans, particularly if you don't have the resources to simply pay for it out of discretionary income of your family, that actually reduces the value of higher education. You know, it makes your net return at a personal level lower than it would otherwise be. Less funding for medical research. Now that seems a really crazy idea. Why in the world would wealthy people who are attacking the affirmative state and want to pay low taxes, why would they want to reduce medical research? I mean, they do get sick after all. The proposed cuts in research on cancer just seem nuts from the point of view of the interests of anybody who knows anything about how science progresses and how advances in medicine work. The idea is that we should have more research that's applied, that's done by pharmaceutical companies, rather than by basic science. In the division of labor in the funding of medical research traditionally is that the affirmative state pays for basic science, and then commercial enterprises, especially pharmaceutical companies, pay for the applied research, you know, the final step in the process where you're actually producing drugs for therapy. Most of the scientific discoveries that lead to drugs are done in universities and research institutes. That is the fundamental breakthroughs that then make possible new medical applications. That comes from university research. And therefore, it just seems crazy to have in a rich society a feeling that we are under such tight budget constraints and taxes are such a bad thing that we should cut back the funding of basic science. But indeed, that's what's happened over the last years. My brother, who is a very high-end cell biologist at the University of Texas Medical School, says that when he began his career, roughly 25 to 30% of all grants to NSF and the NIH were funded, about 30%. Now it's down to 8 to 12%. What he said was that in his judgment, there's probably about 40% of grants that are really serious, clearly worth funding. So 30% was pretty close to getting nearly all of the really good grants. When you get down as low as 10%, it means you're not funding lots of extremely promising research. And what he said, he's on these panels, he does this kind of, you know, screening of research proposals. What he says is that it means that when the panel goes through all the applications, they avoid the high-risk proposals. They feel they have so little money, they're only going to spend it on the sure bets. But that means the cutting-edge stuff, which doesn't necessarily work out, doesn't get funded. So cutting it down from 30% to 20% of proposals getting funded doesn't just mean you don't fund as much research. You don't fund the right kind of research. You fund the safe research, not the most adventurous research. And that's the research that often is a dead end. Otherwise, it would be sure bet. But which also is the source of the biggest, most innovative and surprising breakthroughs. And that's a result of the attack on the affirmative state. I mean, that's the point I want to emphasize. This is the result of a perspective on the state that says the government is the problem, not the solution to our problems. That taxation is theft. Again, that's the extreme caricatured version of the account. There's also less funding for job training, public housing, and so on, which means less funding for those aspects of our collective life which matter most to people who are the most disadvantaged. The people who, for whatever combination of reasons, are facing the greatest obstacles to their positive freedom, to their ability to live a life filled with opportunity. Well, we have less funding for exactly the sorts of things that matter most for those sorts of people. So that's cutbacks of publicly funded programs. Deregulation, that's another part of this. Well, if the government is malevolent, if regulations are all designed to increase the power of bureaucrats, and in any case they're incompetent, let's get rid of them. The mantra, deregulate because it'll be better for everybody, is a constant mantra we hear in attacks on the affirmative state. So here's just three examples. What does deregulation mean? It means weaker regulation of toxic waste. It means weaker regulations of logging. So you'll have more likely to have clear cuts of forests than you did in the past. Weaker regulations of product safety. More likely that products get through which are dangerous. But just as important as deregulation is, so deregulation means you actually remove from the books a regulation. That's deregulation. But just as important is lax enforcement of existing regulations. So we have pretty good health and safety rules for workplaces. You know, rules governing the exposure of people to toxic fumes in a workplace. Rules that regulate how many hours you can work without a break. You know, all sorts of things that concern the health and safety of people within employment. We do have a pretty good set of rules about that. But if you don't have any inspectors who come and check it out, and you reduce the frequency of oversight, how much does it actually matter what the rules on paper are? If the only way that a rule gets enforced is by the workers in a firm suing the company to change the to improve their conditions because they are violating the law, the regulations, if that's the only way it's going to happen, it's not going to happen. It's very tough for workers to sue their employers. And particularly once you get rid of unions. It used to be that unions would be the watchdog on the health and safety conditions within work, and they would make the complaints. They would call in the Occupational Safety and Health Administration inspectors and say, you gotta come to our factory. Well, if you get rid of unions and you reduce the number of inspectors, what happens? Health and safety conditions deteriorate. Fewer auditors of taxes. Well, what's the most likely consequence of having fewer and fewer auditors of taxes? What do you think? What do you think's a pretty obvious consequence of having the probability of having your taxes carefully audited go down? Somebody, what do you think will happen? What's the most likely thing to happen? Evasion, tax evasion, cheating. Tax evasion, that's a kind of soft word, it doesn't sound quite so bad. It's theft. If you cheat on your taxes, you are stealing from the commonweal, from the community. You're stealing. It's not money that belongs to you. That's what a tax system does. It divides the total income into the part that belongs to you and you can do what you want to with, and the part that doesn't belong to you. It's not yours. You pay it at a point in time. That's the tax day of 2 days ago. Or you pay it in withholding taxes, or you pay it in sales taxes. But what you're doing is giving up something that doesn't belong to you. You're giving up something that belongs to the community, to the collective, to the democracy, and it just happens to take this particular mechanism. Well, you reduce auditors, you're going to increase cheating. If you have big cuts in the staff of the Internal Revenue Service, which has happened and is continuing to happen in the proposed budget, another thing that happens is that the frustration of taxpayers who need to answer questions goes up because it's harder to get questions answered. There's fewer people to handle the very big flow of questions that come about their taxes. Fewer food quality inspectors. Fewer food quality inspectors means more occasions of salmonella poisoning, more foodborne diseases, more contaminated hamburger patties that have to be recalled eventually. But without the inspection regime, without the monitoring, it's only when there's an outbreak of illness that you get the recalls, rather than preventative food quality inspection, because you have inspectors and the food processors know that there are sanctions if they aren't careful. That's lax enforcement. And that's a serious consequence of the attack on the affirmative state and a transformation of the character of our political economy. And finally, privatization. We have now a private sector of prisons in the United States. It's a significant part of the prison population are housed in prisons that are not run by local, state, or federal governments. They are run by private corporations trying to maximize their profits. And what's a predictable consequence of having a prison that's trying to maximize profits rather than to maximize the possibilities of rehabilitating and dealing with the problem of persons who don't fit into society well? Well, you can imagine that prison conditions under private prisons are in general much worse than in public prisons. There's also a kind of perverse consequence that happens. Just if you think about it, if you create a big sector of employment in private prisons, where there's investors who are making a lot of money off of contracts with the government for private prisons, what happens? You create a lobbying group that wants tough on crime laws because that provides them the flow of inmates they need to make money. You create a constituency in the society backed by wealth that its interests are not in public safety, they're in making money off of crime, on law enforcement. So get tough on crime is usually thought of as an ideological stance by people who believe that that's simply the best way to protect our society. And you can have an argument about whether get tough on crime or having a more rehabilitation and opportunity-focused way of using our resources. There's a real set of issues around that debate, tough on crime as public safety. But tough on crime as a way of maximizing profits? I mean, that's a really perverse aspect. You don't want your criminal justice system driven by which of the various ways we could organize things will make the biggest profits for particular corporations. That's kind of a crazy way of organizing a crucial public function. Having private prisons generates this problem then, that it creates a well-financed corporate sector committed to putting people in prison. They want longer sentences, harder paroles and probation, and more prisoners, you know, tougher laws. Again, not for purposes of public safety. Of course, they're not going to justify their lobbying on the grounds we need tougher laws in order to make more money. Of course not. They're not going to say that. They're going to fund politicians and fund public service ads that say we need tougher laws in order to control crime. But that will be a rationalization for what's basically a profit-maximizing strategy. Military subcontractors. Now, there's always been military subcontractors. That is, when we think of the military, you think of the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, soldiers. Soldiers are employees of the government. They're paid government employees doing a job that needs to be done. And it used to be the case that things like the commissary, where they could buy food and where meals would be served, would also be run by the government. It used to be the case that the detention facilities that were connected to prisons have jails too, were run by the military. And it used to be that the government didn't subcontract to private corporations to hire independent soldiers that weren't themselves government employees to do the work of the military. Those are called mercenaries. Well, in the recent decades, particularly in the context of the Iraq War, the United States is now in the business of hiring mercenaries, people who are hired guns through private contractors to do the work that used to be done by military uniformed personnel, who were therefore accountable to the chain of command, not accountable to a corporate boss. And another example of privatization are various kinds of public utilities have been privatized. Well, all of that is part of the attack on the affirmative state by saying that private corporations can do the work that used to be done by the government better than the government itself. Now, there may be cases where that's true. I mean, I don't take the view that absolutely everything is better done by a government agency than by a private corporation. But I'm generally skeptical where the public good aspect of the service is so crucial that a profit-maximizing firm is likely to have the public interest most in mind when deciding how to organize the activity, since profit maximization, for good reason, centers around the differences between the costs and the revenues. And if you get your revenues in the form of a government contract and therefore want to cut costs in order to maximize your profits, that seems to me in deep tension with organizing the affairs of the work you do in order to maximize the quality of the service you're providing. Well, those are the transformations of the state that have occurred because of this anti-affirmative state attack that we have seen now in the last 40 years or so. All right, on to today's lecture, democracy and media. So here's the problem. I think it's not controversial to say that if you want a robust, vibrant democracy, where citizens are in a position to really think through the complex problems that the society faces, you need well-informed citizens. It doesn't mean that every citizen has to be well-informed, but you need a high density of pretty well-informed citizens, not necessarily citizens that all agree with each other, of course, but just that their disagreements are anchored in good information, so that it's possible to have a reasoned debate about alternatives, and possible through dialogue to reach, if not consensus, at least some common ground. And that depends upon how well-informed the citizens are. And here's the question. Can a media system dominated by large, profit-driven corporations provide sufficient good quality information for citizens of a democracy? We live in a media system in which the news and information that's relevant to democratic decision-making are provided primarily by large, profit-driven corporations. That's just a fact of the nature of our media system. And the question then is, how well suited to a really well-functioning democracy is a media system that's dominated by that kind of organization? Well, let's explore the character of this problem. The standard view, I think, is this. The free press, the word free in free press, means the free market press. That is, it's free from government regulation. When we talk about the free press, we mean a press that's free from government regulation. The government isn't giving you the news. The government isn't regulating the news. It's given by through the free market. There's an expression, the free marketplace of ideas, which corresponds to this image of a free press as a free market press. The free marketplace of ideas says that the best ideas are just like products. The best ideas will survive the competition of the market. If you have a free marketplace of ideas, then the best ideas rise to the top, just as if you have a free marketplace in automobiles, the crappy automobiles will not be purchased, and the good quality, safe automobiles that satisfy the needs of consumers will be the ones that people buy. The critical assumption is that the only threat to a free press is government control, not private wealthy elites. My general position is that these are two threats. We have two threats we have to cope with. I do think that government control of the press is a big problem. That is definitely a threat to democracy when you have a government-controlled press. Government censorship is a significant problem at times and in different times and places, and it can become the absolutely most crucial problem that a free press faces. Government regulation, government repression. But I think there's a second threat to a free press, which comes from the character of the private control over the press, rather than the public regulation of the press. And in some times and places, the threat to the freeness of the free press, its role as a place where free deliberation and information freely, I don't mean free in the sense that it's costlessly produced, information that contributes to public debate, is the freedom of that press is curtailed by the power of its patrons, its owners. We have two threats to the freedom of the press, one from the state. We have laws which try to block the regulation of the press by the state, and the United States is pretty good on that. Not perfect, but if you compare the United States to most places, we have pretty strong rules in place to protect the freedom of the press. It's very aggravating to some people. They think that freedom of the press has gone too far. It opens the door to pornography and to fake news. I mean, all these sorts of problems in the press are opened up because the press is not censored. But I also think we have a threat to free press because of the character of who owns it, not simply the state. So there are four problems then in the standard view. Four problems in the standard view. First is private corporate control of media content. And it's based on a very simple fact. The private wealthy owners of every media source that is privately owned, we have a few that aren't, they have the right and the power to control the content of the news. And that's true if it's the New York Times, if it's the Washington Post, if it's Fox News, if it's MSNBC. These are all privately owned media outlets, and the owners have the right to establish restrictions on the content. And one question you ask, is it likely that if private wealthy owners control all of these media outlets, is this likely to generate any particular kind of bias within the media, within the news? Is it likely to generate what could broadly be thought of as a pro-business bias within the media? Not that there will be unanimity, but that overall the media will be biased towards the interests of wealth holders rather than the interests of ordinary people or the poor. It's pretty hard to give an account of how media works in which you would imagine in this instance, media owners would somehow be perfectly happy with newspapers that attacked them. Unlike what we normally think about people acting in their self-interest. And indeed, I think the spectrum of legitimate opinion that we see in the mass media, both broadcast media and print media, ranges from the moderate liberal to the extreme right. The part of the spectrum that kind of begins with Bernie Sanders and moves leftwards, you know, the left part of the spectrum of possible views about the world and how it works are largely excluded as outside the bounds of legitimate opinion, whereas extreme right-wing positions are well represented in the mainstream media. Now, journalists themselves may be on average relatively liberal. They tend to be sort of on the liberal side of center, the actual journalists, the people who do the investigating. But journalists do not really get to decide what goes into the news. Reporters don't write newspapers. Reporters present the news, and then editors, who are directly under the control of owners, decide what goes in and what goes out, and they edit. That's why they're called editors. They edit the news dispatches which they receive. Reporters and editors almost always are severely constrained by the interests of the media and the interests of advertisers. We'll get to that in a moment. A second problem with the standard view. The standard view really depends upon there being intense competition in the market. That is, even for products, right? For ordinary market competition, the only reason why the best products end up being those that survive and why there's this even remote claim to consumer sovereignty in the market for products is if there's competition. Profit-driven, market-oriented newspaper system has an intense, inherent tendency to lead to concentration. Large newspaper chains develop. Most cities in the United States now have only one newspaper. It used to be that big cities in the United States would have dozens of newspapers. Five or six that would be very prominent, another dozen or so that would be of secondary interest. Madison used to have two competing newspapers with very different perspectives. Now it really has only one. It has a second that's an online newspaper, but it no longer plays the role as a poll within the community for alternative views to have kind of equal representation on the editorial pages, but more than just on the editorial pages where opinions are presented, in the decisions about what kinds of topics to cover and how to cover them. The patterns of concentration of media in the United States have been stunning, and they've really led to what we can call a media empires. Here's a graph that comes, it's in the book as well. The number of corporations that dominate the media industry, taken as a whole. In the early 1980s, it was roughly 50 firms that dominated the overall landscape of the mass media. By the 1990s, it was down to a couple dozen. Now it's under five. Disney and Time Warner are the best examples, with a dozen or so second-tier firms. Competition becomes very muted when you have such a small number of firms. Some people then say, well, what about the internet? Now, the internet certainly is a free-for-all. There are thousands of news sites on the internet. And it looks like, well, maybe the internet is a new platform, a new environment, a media environment in which we are recreating the older form of there being many competing newspapers in a city, because you have many competing ways of getting news. It turns out that if you look closely at news sites in the internet, virtually all of them are parasitic on other news sites on the internet. That is, they are what are called news aggregators, rather than engaging in actual reporting and investigative journalism. The key thing about classical newspapers is they didn't simply report the news that they got from other newspapers. They actually had reporters who went out and investigated news. That was crucial for local politics. The local reporter who would be reporting on local corruption and local development plans and the fate of a beloved park that was going to be, you know, attacked for some reason or rebuilt for some reason. All of these debates were fought out in local newspapers, but that required local reporters who would gather the news, who would interview the relevant people, who would observe, and in some cases do hard, long-term investigation. The news sites on the internet overwhelmingly don't do that. And why? Because it takes a lot of resources to pay people to actually do investigative journalism. The internet, therefore, is mostly an aggregator from other news sources. And if the other news sources are either dominated by highly concentrated forms of media or underfunded by people who are doing this on a amateur hobbyist basis, the quality of the news generated in the internet will not respond to the decline of competition and variability within the mainstream news environment. Third problem with the standard view: advertising and profit maximization. Well, profit maximizing newspapers make money primarily because of advertising, and television, of course, as well. The main way that both newspapers and the news media on television make money is through advertising. This means that the profit-making goal is to actually attract advertisers. That's a kind of strange thing. You get people to watch your shows, but what you really want to do is to attract advertisers. That's how you make money, by attracting advertisers. That's why Bill O'Reilly got fired this week, right? Because advertisers left Fox News. Fox News loved Bill O'Reilly. There's no antagonism whatsoever between Rupert Murdoch and Bill O'Reilly in terms of the political views he held. His sexual practices were, you know, and his harassment tendencies were a problem, but they weren't a problem to Rupert Murdoch until they became public news. And then it became only a problem once advertisers started withdrawing from the show. Because that's what Fox News really cares about, is advertisers. But how do you get more advertisers? You have to get your media to be viewed by people, but not just any old people. You want your viewers to be the kind of people that your advertisers want to advertise to. You basically, the more you can attract affluent people to your audiences, people who buy lots of things, the more attractive your media will be to advertisers. It's much better to have a show watched by 5 million rich people than 10 million poor people, from the point of view of your average advertiser. You want your shows to be watched by people who spend a lot of money. And that creates a systematic bias in the way commercial media of whatever sort orients its media activity. And this is true whether it be entertainment or whether it be investigative journalism, whatever you're talking about. What they want to do is attract people who are the sorts of people that the advertisers like, because they make their money not from the viewers directly, but they make their money from the advertisers. Subscription prices in newspapers are a small part of the revenue of newspapers. The New York Times, which has a large subscription base, still makes more money from its advertising than it does from its subscribers. And this also means that news is designed to be inoffensive to advertisers. You don't want to piss off your advertisers with your news. So you are unlikely to have news stories that directly attack your principal advertisers. And you're not going to want to piss off your core constituency of viewers if that means that they will stop watching and therefore reduce the attractiveness of your audiences to your advertisers. All of this then creates a problem for the idea of a free press. Remember, that's the point of this discussion. We need a free press that's really free, free from domination by the state, free from domination by special interests, particularly interests of the wealthy in this case. We need it to be free from those two kinds of domination. And there's all these mechanisms built into the private ownership, especially when it becomes concentrated, that cut in the other direction, subordinates the media to these external criteria. Profit maximizing attracts advertisers. What kind of advertisers do we want? Those that advertise to wealthy people. And finally, the general bottom line preoccupation of investors in corporations, they're concerned about the rate of profit, means that short-term profit maximization becomes the central focus of media CEOs. And this leads to pressures for cost cutting. There are many implications of this. Some of these are discussed in the book. Let me just give you one particularly poignant example. What's the cheapest way to get information from government officials? One way is that you go to press conferences and read their press releases, and then you report the press release of the government as news. But what's a press release? A press release is the way the government, or a press release of a corporation, it's the way they want you to think about what they're doing. It's a lot more trouble to actually investigate what a corporation is doing or what the government is really doing by interviewing a lot of people, by interviewing the disgruntled employees, by interviewing the non-propagandistic spokespeople in the Environmental Protection Agency, rather than just reporting news based on PR and press releases. Press releases are news that is generated by elites in their own interests rather than by reporters examining events. Well, it turns out that somewhere in excess of 50% of everything you read in newspapers that's described as news is derived from press releases rather than from investigative reporters talking to people, looking for documents, trying to figure out what's going on. A news system that relies on press releases from official organs of either business or the state or other official elite organizations that relies on that to define the news gets very close to being an outlet for the propaganda of those organizations. The result of all this is a massive downsizing of journalistic staffs. Newspapers employ many fewer reporters than they used to. Closing of foreign offices. Very few newspapers now have foreign offices. The New York Times being and the Wall Street Journal being exceptions, but even they have cut back on their staffs. And certainly a decline of investigative journalism. One of the most striking examples of how all of these processes have played out is in broadcast radio. This is a picture of the district. This is also in the book, so you don't have to try to take any notes on this. This is the distribution of ownership of radio stations in the United States in 2001. I haven't been able to find a more updated pie chart. It may have changed a bit, but I think since this occurred in the aftermath of the big deregulation of ownership in the 1990s, I suspect that it's pretty much the same, or perhaps even more concentrated today. So here's the basic issue. When radio first began in the US, it wasn't at all clear that it would be dominated by commercial broadcasters. You know, the first radio station in the whole United States was here at Wisconsin. The Wisconsin University public radio station was the first broadcaster. And 100 years ago this year, they're celebrating their centenary, Wisconsin Public Radio. It wasn't called Wisconsin Public Radio. I think it was called WXM or something back then. But it was the first radio station. And until the 1920s, it wasn't at all clear. Was the broadcast spectrum going to be mainly public institutions using it to broadcast programs of various sorts, or was it going to be sold off to private commercial broadcasters? There is a problem in the radio spectrum. You just can't have a free-for-all because then the signals would interfere with each other. You know, so you have to allocate the spectrum, but the spectrum is out there. You know, it's in nature. There's no natural property right in the radio spectrum. So it was publicly owned, and then the question is, how should this be handled? Should it be leased out to private broadcasters where they pay a rent to have access, but in which you can put conditions on the rent? You can only use this if you do X, Y, and Z. Or should it just be sold outright and let people do what the hell they want with the spectrum? The United States in the 1930s decided that the basic solution was to privatize the airwaves, to sell off pieces of the radio spectrum to private companies, but then because the airwaves were a public resource, to provide strong regulation to see that broadcasting would be at least thinly in the public interest. And in particular, there were severe rules imposed on broadcasters, restricting a single firm owning more than one radio station in a given broadcasting market. You just were not allowed to own more than one station. And further, there were restrictions on ownership concentration across markets. It basically blocked the possibility of empires, of broadcasting empires in radio. Those rules were relaxed in the 1990s. It was under the guise, I think it was called the modernization of the Federal Communications Commission's regulations of the spectrum. And that has led to this tremendous concentration of radio. Now here's the interesting thing about radio stations. Radio could be a deeply democratic medium. It's not really that expensive to have a local radio station. There are really not big economies of scale. You know, you don't produce more efficiently if you own 1,200 stations than if you own one or two. That's the actual work that's done in the station and the cost of building the antennas and getting it going. Where is an economy of scale if you're big is the ability to attract advertisers. So Clear Channel can create these huge contracts for advertising on radio, which gives it a huge competitive advantage over smaller radio stations. But that's not a competitive advantage in the actual production of content on radio. It's an advantage in acquiring resources through advertising. And so which would define the efficiency. What's the best way of thinking about the efficiency in this kind of market? Is the real efficiency that we care about the efficiency in your ability to attract advertisers? Is that the kind of efficiency that we value? Or is it the efficiency in producing content that's geared to the local environment, in which there's local musicians and local news reporters and local people who are engaged in local radio? Well, we've gone down a particular path in the United States. It's important to note, at the very beginning of the American Republic, one of the very first things that Congress did was create the U.S. postal system. And one of the first things that was debated in the creation of the U.S. postal system centered around the issue of postal rates for newspapers. The postal system in the late 18th and 19th century was the primary way that newspapers were delivered throughout the country. That's how people got newspapers, was through the mail. And there were proposals in the first Congress that actually the Postal Service should deliver newspapers for free. They shouldn't charge any postage. The reasoning was that newspapers were crucial for an informed citizenry. That was something necessary for the Republic to be vibrant, and that it was a worthwhile public subsidy to pay for the costs, not of producing the newspapers — they would still be a free press unregulated by the government — but distributing the newspapers. That should be done for free. A massive subsidy. You know, it's interesting that one of the first acts of the federal government was to figure out how best to subsidize the free press. They ended up with a very small charge for newspapers, way below the costs. So it remained a highly subsidized part of the postal system. So we do have a long tradition going back to the founding fathers. And if, you know, if the founding fathers are this mythical group of wise people who really had the long-term fundamental problems in their minds as they solved the immediate problems which they encountered, then this would be one case where I said, yeah, they got it right, and we should have a system in which there is massive public subsidy of the democratic media so that it wouldn't be captured by large corporate interests. The fundamental idea is that a vibrant, high-quality free press in the public interest is a public good. It's not just a private good. It's a public good. It's in my interest to have a vibrant democratic media, including a media that disagrees completely with what I believe. Because I believe the world is a better place where my ideas and beliefs are not the only ones available. Where my ideas and beliefs about politics, about social change, about best policies, about where we should go as a country, are constantly debated and interrogated by people who disagree with it. In that sense, I do believe in the free marketplace of ideas, so long as it's an actual free marketplace, as opposed to a marketplace dominated by powerful organizations. Capitalist markets generally do a poor job in providing public goods. That's a general feature of markets oriented around profit maximizing. They may be great for some things, they're not great for providing public goods. Public goods need some kind of systematic public support. They require subsidy or direct public provision. So there are three kinds of broadcast. Let's just focus on broadcast media, but you know, these points could be made about any kind of media. The three kinds: there's commercial for-profit broadcast media, there are state-owned broadcast media — we have Wisconsin Public Radio — and we have nonprofit community media. These are all different ways in which media content is provided. I think there's a role for all three of these. What I don't think is optimal is a media system in which the first is so dominant and is itself so dominated by large corporations that the second and third at best adapt and fit into small niches within the overall media landscape. Other places in the world have much stronger public non-commercial sector paid by taxes and justified by the public ownership of the airways and the public interest. In the United Kingdom, for example, you pay a tax on a TV that pays for the BBC. You have to, just like you have a vehicle registration fee when you buy a car and you have to renew your vehicle registration periodically, and that helps to pay for various services relevant to automobiles, you have to have a license to have a television, essentially, in Britain. And you pay a fee, and that fee funds the BBC. This puts much greater resources at the disposal, traditionally, of the BBC, both for its news-gathering capacity and for its public interest broadcasting. One of the reasons why Americans are so fond of BBC dramas, Masterpiece Theater and other things, is because of the high production values which they have traditionally contained. Now, recently, the BBC has come under huge financial pressure to be more efficient, to be more profitable, and it is being pushed in a direction that will make it more and more like commercial broadcasting. Public broadcasting in the United States, PBS and NPR, these are a kind of mixed form. They get their revenues from donations, from corporate sponsors, from foundations, and a small part, less than 15%, from taxes. They're constantly under attack by conservatives. A part of the attack on the affirmative state is to remove funding for public broadcasting. And periodically in the initial round of budgeting, you see a zeroing out of funding from the government for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is this independent body that receives tax funding from the government. Whenever those attacks occur, you will get people who will bring out Big Bird, and Big Bird will say, kind of tearfully, "Don't defund us." You know, Big Bird is one of my favorite characters. This is a total digression. I just want to tell you my favorite expression from Big Bird, which I tell my students, my graduate students, when they're suffering from not feeling that their work is as brilliant as they want it to be. I say, you know, Big Bird says, the best you can do is the best you can do. And I think it's actually such a deeply profound idea about how you should think about your work. You should try to do your best because it's good to do your best. It's gratifying. But it really is the case that the best you can do is the best you can do. So if that is the best you can do, don't moan and groan about it and don't feel bad about it. You've accomplished the best you can do. All right, that was a digression. Triggered by a random thought about the beloved Yellow Bird, who once again is under attack. Actually, Sesame Street was displaced from public broadcasting. It's now on HBO and only gets on PBS 6 months later. So PBS does still broadcast Sesame Streets, but 6 months delay from the broadcasting on HBO, and that's again because of cuts in public funding. It was no longer viable to have that program continually produced through public money and donations. Okay, so we've got these three kinds of media. I want to explore the problem of what it would take to create a vibrant, democracy-enhancing media system in the United States. I think there are four key elements. First, prohibit media empires and conglomerates. That's a pretty simple point. If a democratic media is crucial in the public interest, you can't have concentrations of power because that is a threat to the free press. Prohibit media empires and conglomerates. Break them up. The public, non-commercial, non-profit media sector should be the dominant sector in broadcasting. Not the only sector, But it should occupy the kind of center place around which other forms of media then adapt, rather than it squeezing in around the corners. We should also have a system that encourages a very diverse form of ownership of media. Of course, you should have private firms as well, but employee cooperatives, community stations, university stations, nonprofit corporations should have a pluralism of forms of organization rather than have it be dominated by a single type. And we should figure out ways of providing serious public subsidies, but without state control. Public subsidies, but without state control. State control is dangerous because the state control of the media, which can work okay under some circumstances, always has the risk of the state dominating the media and turning it to its own purposes or the purposes of whatever political elite is dominant within the state. And yet we need public money going into the media. We have such a system, but not one that I think is optimal in the form of the relationship between the state and religion. As I described last time in the discussion of taxation, the American government provides enormous subsidies to religion, but without control. That is, the state doesn't decide what counts as good theology and bad theology. And it even really doesn't even decide what counts as religion. I mean, there are some things that call themselves churches that are pretty sketchy from a religious point of view, from anybody, I think, any ordinary religious point of view. And some of them are clearly scams. They're ways of getting nonprofit status and therefore getting subsidies of through the tax expenditures. That's not true for most churches, even most, you know, small and unusual churches, but it is true for some. But the main point is the government has very loose criteria for what counts as a church because it doesn't want to control the religion, and that's a good thing. So public subsidies, but without state control. That's what the Postal Service used to be for newspapers. It was a subsidy, free or minimal cost to sending out newspapers, but the state didn't control the content. There's two ways of providing public subsidies of information media as a public good. You could return the airwaves to public control and treat it as a public resource. And you can create, and this is a novel proposal, it's discussed at the end of the chapter, you can create what could be called targeted refundable tax credit, not a tax deduction, to support nonprofit media. Let me explain what that is. This is a proposal by Bob McChesney, who's a media analyst at University of Illinois, and John Nichols, who's a local, very well-known national news reporter and kind of editorial writer, John Nichols. The proposal can be called tax-financed journalism vouchers. So here's how it works. And this is just to illustrate, when I say $200 a year, that is just that's the proposal that Nichols and McChesney give. Obviously, the amount could vary. So each citizen receives a $200 a year tax credit to give to a news journalism organization of their choice. This is like, remember the democracy dollars idea around elections, where everybody got $50 a year to spend on politics? So the tax system provides you with the money, but the individual citizen allocates it to politics. That's government subsidy without government control. This is the same thing, but it's applied to journalism. So let's say each citizen gets $200 a year in the form of a refundable tax credit, not a deduction, meaning it's the same for every citizen. You don't get to give out more if you're rich, which it would be the case if it was a tax deduction. A tax credit means it's the same for each person. Organizations that receive tax vouchers then have to meet certain criteria. And here's just some examples. We could add or subtract criteria depending upon how restrictive or expansive you wanted this to be. A news organization that is eligible for the $200 a year tax credit would have restrictions placed on the role of advertising. It could even be no advertising, but there might be reasons to say that it could have advertising that would cover up to, let's say, 25% of its revenues. You know, you could decide variable ways of imposing that restriction. Organizations that receive the tax vouchers should be nonprofit. That means they should not be organizations in which wealthy investors are getting a return on their investment depending upon the success of the organization, the news organization. And they need to be certified by some kind of professional journalism association. That, of course, could vary in its character, as a real news organization. Whenever you create a government subsidy, you open the door for scams, right? That some group sets themselves up as a phony news organization. They don't actually do anything. They get 100 people together and call themselves journalists, and then they each donate their $200, which otherwise would go to a news organization, to themselves, and pocket the money for themselves. So that, you know, you get a scam newspaper just for the purpose of getting the non-refundable tax credits from the people who call themselves that news organization. Well, that's clearly a scam. And so you need some way of certifying, yes, this is a legitimate news organization. Now, that certification problem is necessary if you're going to have subsidies. We have such certification practices for nonprofit organizations. You have to meet certain criteria. We have them for churches, although very loose for churches because of the hesitancy of the state to really impose restrictions on religion. You know, so we can have the Church of Scientology in the United States, which was based on a science fiction writer's fantasies. And it is debatable. Lots of people think this is not a church. Some people think it is. Well, the government is very hesitant to make a judgment, so it has this loose criteria. For the journalism vouchers idea, I think probably stricter criteria are needed. You'd have to be able to have a professional journalism association that would decide what really counts as a news organization, and that would then make them available for these citizen contributions. Well, that would be a way, then, of creating a democratic news-generating system. Individuals would still allocate the resources. The government wouldn't decide what counts as good news or bad news, what ideological perspective should be present. Lots of people would contribute to newspapers and news sources that are mainly concerned with scandals of celebrities. But enough money would then flow into serious investigative journalism and democracy-relevant journalism to enhance the vitality of a democratic media system. Next week, we will begin with what I think is perhaps the most controversial lecture of the whole semester. It's certainly the one that I've gotten the most flack for, on the problem of militarism, the military and democracy in the United States. See you then.